The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. We're in Jerusalem. We're actually taping this segment in advance in Jerusalem with a special guest, Melanie Phillips, the distinguished author. She's authored many books over the years, Londinistan, The World Turned Upside Down, and the one that we'll focus on more today, Guardian Angel, which you can get all of these at Amazon. And also, she frequently appears on BBC's Question Time, as well as the BBC Radio. She's a panelist on Moral Maze, as she was explaining to us earlier this evening. So, Melanie Phillips, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to see you.
Okay, so today, Mondays are always a deadline for you as far as writing?
Monday is the day I write my column for the London Times.
Okay.
I write other things as well. I write for the Jerusalem Post and the Jewish Chronicle in London once a month. And I write books and I broadcast on the BBC, as you've said. So
yes.
But the Times is my main weekly column.
Yes. And so what was the subject that you were delving into today?
Today I was writing my column on proposals that were being debated in Parliament, in fact, this evening, today. On a new compulsory curriculum of sex education in schools, which is controversial because it ordains that children, including in primary school, should be introduced to what I would call sexual lifestyle equality and choice. The whole sort of gay union, transgender agenda. In order to teach children to be tolerant, and also to protect them, because they will also be taught about things like female genital mutilation, and forced marriage, and stuff like that, to cope with Britain's Muslim minority, where these are serious issues, and it's very controversial. Because a lot of parents do not like the idea of their children being taught about alternative sexual lifestyles or transgender values, which directly conflict with their own much more traditional values if they are Christian, Jewish or Muslim,
right,
or indeed of no religion but have a traditional attitude towards these things. And they feel that it's not right for this the state to be, as they would see it, usurping the role of parents. So this is the argument that I've waded into in the Times.
Now, in your book, Guardian Angel, you were writing about, this was many, many years ago, you talked about how that when you first started writing on subjects that were maybe more for conservatives or something that conservatives would agree with, that it was like 3-1. The hate mail that you get would be maybe 75%, but then you were really encouraged by the ones that would write in and say, hey, thank you for writing about that. Do you find it's about the same? Do you get the same level of...
I can't really give an informed estimate of what the proportions are.
Yeah.
But I can say with confidence that the overwhelming weight of opinion in the media and in the intelligentsia, the universities and the cultural life of Britain is on the other side to me, politically and morally and culturally. The people that I find I have such a, my writing has such resonance with are people who are not part of that gilded elite. And they support me very considerably. I mean, when I go to London, it may sound rather egocentric to say this, but it is a notable fact that I'm often recognised, and people come up to me and say, please carry on, you speak for millions of us, and so on. And that's the kind of thing that's kept me going, because the amount of vilification and flack and uproar that comes my way over virtually everything I write from people who have access to the culture is extraordinary. And so it's very important to me to know that I have a following which is among, you know, the decent people of Britain,
right,
which is extremely large.
Yeah. So just producing podcasts as we do and doing some writing here and there, we're always fascinated by someone who's obviously been writing for a long time, whether it's for books or for newspapers as you do. And you, of course, are a regular commentator, as I said at the start. But just to take one weekly assignment for the London Times, what your deadline's on Monday, so what's some of the behind-the-scenes work? Do you decide maybe a few days in advance what subject you're going to get into? And then is it all weekend, or is it mainly confined to your work on Monday? Or how's the process play out?
It's not possible to say where it starts and finishes. It just goes on all the time in terms of the work that I do that goes into these columns.
Yeah.
And the ideas often come, you know, out of all the reading and thinking I've been doing and watching what's going on and talking to people. And some of them are ideas which are not reflected necessarily in the mainstream media at that point. And some of them are. And as the week goes on, I form a view about the sort of things that are, you know, particularly interesting me. And then on Sunday, I talk to the people who deal with my column in London at the Times and put forward some ideas. Sometimes I will put forward one idea if I really want to write about that. But usually I have a whole variety of ideas I put to them. And then we have a discussion, which may take place on Sunday. It goes into Monday sometimes. Sometimes it goes into Monday rather late, from my point of view, because I have to write the wretched thing on Monday.
Right.
And it's up to them to tell me what they think is the most suitable thing for me to write, bearing in mind the level of interest that they think their readers will have in that subject that day,
right,
which they're entitled to.
Sure.
It's a judgment they're entitled to make.
Yeah. And so for the Jerusalem Post, you write for that too, but is that every week as
well? I write for the Jerusalem Post every 2 weeks, and on alternate weeks, I write for something called the Jewish News Syndicate,
okay,
which, as the name implies, is a Jewish organization, a newspaper, a writing syndicate,
right,
which sends, which has a website,
yeah,
and it also sells pieces to Jewish newspapers. And between the Jerusalem Post and the Jewish News Syndicate on alternative weeks, I write about Jewish topics specifically. I write about issues in the world which are of particular concern or interest to the Jewish community, either in Israel or in the diaspora.
Right. So in your book, maybe you can tell us a little bit about your upbringing, or what, maybe more so your education. You talk in your book, Guardian Angel, about just some of the difficulties in your family that led up to your worldview, and then how that you went through this transformation following college and your early years at The Guardian. How can you summarize that, I guess, briefly? It's as hard as that is to do.
Well, I mean, briefly, the kind of background I had was very typical of British Jewish families at that time. I mean, I was born, you know, just after the Second World War. British Jewish families at that time were not particularly observant and not particularly religious. And my family they belonged to an Orthodox synagogue, so they weren't progressive in their religious views at all. But they were not observant in that they didn't go to synagogue more than on the high holy days of Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah. But we were kosher at home and kosher out, which was perhaps quite unusual. So we were, you know, I was brought up with a very distinct sense of Jewish identity. The family was, my father was a man of extremely modest means. He had no formal education. He'd left school when he was 13, and he sold women's dresses from a vehicle, from a van. And my mother ran a shop selling children's clothes. They were what we would call in Britain lower middle class. I was the only child. And they had virtually no money. They lived in a rented apartment all their lives. And when they died with no assets. And what money they had, they poured into me. and they bought my education. They gave me a private education, which at the time, you know, cost a lot of money. Because like many Jewish families, they of that period, they wanted to their children to rise up, and be much more prosperous and more settled and integrated than they were. They were both born in Britain, but they were not prosperous, and they were not educated, and they didn't have the opportunities that they wanted for me. So I went to Oxford University, where I read English literature. And I then was trained in these. In those days, you actually had to be trained as a journalist before having a chance of working for a national paper. As you know, in Britain, we have national papers,
right,
and they're the papers that everybody wanted to work for. And in those days, you couldn't work for a national paper, which was kind of the pinnacle of journalism, unless you'd been trained properly on a, what was then a two-year training scheme with a local paper. And on, and in those days, you were taught the essence of journalism, which was, you know, you were taught that your aim was to be objective, to tell the truth, to be fair and balanced, to give the other side, always to be sceptical, to check your sources, accuracy, all these things which we were taught, which now are like gone by the board. And we were taught the difference between opinion and fact. Again, gone by the board. So I was given this very, very rigorous journalistic training. Looking back, it was rigorous by today's standards. And I worked on this training paper for a couple of years it was quite near to London, in Hertfordshire. And then I worked for a magazine called New Society, which no longer exists, which was a kind of strange hybrid. It was a kind of bridge between academia and journalism. So academics who wanted to be journalists wrote for it, and journalists who wanted to be academics wrote for it. And it concentrated on social policy. And from there I went to The Guardian, where I thought, as I was describing Guardian Angel, I thought I was in absolute heaven. Because at the time, you see, my family was, as I say, very, very modest means. And like many, many, many Jewish people at the time, my family was, you know, tribally Labour Party supporting. It couldn't conceive. My parents could never have conceived voting anything other than the Labour Party, because they, as far as they were concerned, the world was divided into the boss class and the working class, the little man, and they were the little man. And it was inconceivable to vote for the Conservative Party, because that was the boss class, so you voted for the Labour Party. And that's the way I was brought up, and that's the way many, many of us were brought up. Now, over time, the Jewish community changed. It's different from the Jewish community in America, which remains 70% vote Democrat.
Right.
In Britain, I don't know what the percentage is, but the majority of British Jews now vote Conservative. Mm. They, as they became more prosperous, they became bourgeois, their voting accordingly changed. My family didn't. My family never became bourgeois. It remained stuck. And anyway, so I went to The Guardian. I didn't consider myself to be left-wing. Again, it's a slight cultural difference with America. In Britain, we certainly used to divide up between liberals and left. And to be left was socialist. And to be liberal was a different tradition altogether. To be liberal was just to be tolerant and to maintain a distinction between the public and the private space. It was a sort of classical liberalism, going back to the English and Scottish Enlightenment. Whereas left-wingery is very much more coercive, and it's an ideology. And at the time, I thought the two were synonymous in Britain. And I thought The Guardian, which had a tradition as a liberal newspaper going back, but became progressively more left-wing. I didn't realise the distinction. I didn't realise that it was becoming something different from what it originally was.
Mm-hmm.
For example, originally, when it was the Manchester Guardian, it was based in Manchester, and it was a liberal paper. And as a liberal paper, as the Manchester Guardian, for example, it was one of the key newspapers which supported the establishment of the State of Israel. Whereas when I started to work for it, it had been in London for several years. And it had changed its character from being, it was beginning to change, it had already changed considerably its character and was going to change much more from shedding liberalism
right.
to becoming really hard-edged left-wing.
Mm-hmm.
And it became very, very hostile to Israel, as an example of this great change. Anyway, I was unaware of this at the time because, as far as I was concerned, it was the pinnacle of what I wanted to be in journalism. It was a wonderfully written newspaper. It still is. It's the best written newspaper of all.
Yeah.
It's just highly literate, very, very intelligent. And it was staffed by highly literate, very intelligent individuals. I thought we all believed the same thing. We all believed in making a better world. We all believed in standing up against abuses of power. We believed in conscience, social conscience, in doing the right thing by everybody, in looking after the vulnerable, and so on. And I still hold to all those principles. Those have not changed for me at all. What did change very dramatically was my perception of where those principles resided. And the fact that the people on The Guardian, and by The Guardian I mean the people on the left in Britain, or the liberal left in Britain, as they called themselves, were not on the same side at all,
mm-hmm.
that they purported to be. They made a tremendous noise about it, standing up for the oppressed against the oppressor, standing up for the victim against the victimizer. But actually, they stood for the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something they couldn't see. And I went through issue after issue on this with this dawning realization. It took me a very long time.
Well, but, the course of the 80s, pretty much.
Of course, the 80s, yes, indeed. Course of the 80s and indeed the 90s. And it progressed from education through family breakdown, through multiculturalism, and then through man-made global warming, and then through Islamism, and heaven knows what else. And it took me a very long time because... The Guardian, like the left in general, is a kind of tribal, it's a kind of tribe and it's a kind of family. And you belong to that tribe and you belong to that family. And I still think of it in that way, but it's a bit like, you suddenly realise your family's been abusing you for years and you can't live with them anymore because they're terrible. So you have to go. And they hate you because you said you're abusing me. But they're still your family. And... I didn't really find that the people who then embraced me, who were the right, defined by the left as anyone who's not the left,
right.
To a certain extent, they were quite ideological at that time. I'm talking about the 80s. It was Mrs. Thatcher's, the time of Mrs. Thatcher's premiership. I wasn't that keen on Mrs. Thatcher. I still am not, retrospectively. I think she was a great lady and did some great things. She defeated the unions. That was a great thing. She understood about liberty. That was great. She understood about Britain needing to rescue itself from the perception, the self-perception of its own decline, which created a decline. She understood all of that. That was very, very good, unique to her. And she was a great lady as a result. However, it also seemed to me that she represented a strand of what emerged under the banner of the Conservative Party and called itself conservatism, but actually it wasn't conservatism at all. It was actually a kind of wrecking ideology. It was what was called Manchester liberalism, to be accurate. And it was to do with the consumer being supreme. And she saw everything through the prism, it seemed to me, of economics, money. And it was a kind of utilitarian calculation that she made. And as a result, it seemed to me she was throwing out a lot of stuff that she thought was a kind of conspiracy against the individual, a conspiracy against the consumer, which was anything to do with tradition and those intangible qualities upon which Britain used to run, such as loyalty and trust, and knowing where the boundaries were without them having to be spelled out in a written constitution. We all knew this. We all kind of knew where the boundaries were. And as a result, we had things like trust and we had things like loyalty. And I believe she destroyed them in large measure, for example, in the civil service. The civil service was one of the great creations of then Prime Minister Gladstone back in the 19th century. It was one of the great creations for the world. A disinterested civil service, free of any political influence, which would go from administration to administration and give the same advice to all governments, disinterested on the basis of reality and truth. And it went. You had to do what Mrs. Thatcher wanted. That was a terrible thing. And we've never recovered. Britain's never recovered from that. So, again, I have a problem with that, which remains a problem. But so I was never comfortable with the people who the left called the right, because a lot of them were completely gung-ho free marketeers. And I believe that just as the left had adopted extreme individualism in the social and cultural sphere, no such thing as authority, everything was to do with me, what is right for me is what is right, everything was moral and cultural relativism, and everything had gone to pot as a result of that. The conservative free marketeers were applying the same thing to the realm of economics and kind of civic organisation, if you like. I was in a kind of no man's land, really.
one of the points you make several times in the book, which I loved, is you talked about just going where the facts or the evidence leads you. And so, if I'm hearing you right, you're basically there to defend truth and to proclaim truth, and whether the left disagrees with that or the right disagrees with that, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, I go where the evidence leads me. I form an opinion based on the evidence that I see. I'm always very conscious that I may have got it wrong, that I may have misinterpreted the evidence, or I may have missed some. And so I'm always listening to what people are saying about why I'm wrong. And I have changed my mind. I mean, famously, I changed my mind completely about everything you could say when I, moved from what was called the left to what was called the right. This is what drives people on the left completely crazy, because they don't accept evidence. They refract evidence through the prism of an ideology. And the ideology brooks no dissent. Why does it brook no dissent? Because these ideologies that the left subscribes to are all basically what I would call apocalyptic, millenarian ideologies. They all believe in the perfection of the world. And because they all believe in the perfection of the world, multiculturalism will excise prejudice from the human heart. The end of the Western nation state will prevent war from ever happening again. Fighting man-made global warming will save the planet from frying. Anyone who objects to any of that is not simply wrong, therefore, they're actually evil, in their view, because you're standing against the betterment of humanity. So that is why you can't actually have an argument with them. They don't want to hear an argument. They just want to destroy you, because they have to destroy you because you're evil. And so you get insult, not argument. And I also have thought over the years, as I've been subjected to all this insult, that, if you're confident in your view, you are very happy to have an argument with somebody, because you're not terrified that they may persuade you you're wrong. The world will not end for you if they persuade you you're wrong. You'll be pretty cross, maybe. You'll be pretty cheesed off. You may be furious even, and you may be quite depressed. But you won't disintegrate as a moral personality. The people who won't have the argument, who just shout Nazi, fascist, me, Nazi, fascist, they don't want to have the argument. Why? Because they're frightened. What are they frightened of? They're frightened they're going to lose it. Why are they frightened they're going to lose it? Because they know that they cannot maintain their argument in the face of evidence. So I may get the evidence wrong, but I go to the evidence and I say, here is the evidence. So they don't want to know the evidence, because that might mean that they're wrong, in which case they will fragment. That's how I see it.
Yeah.
I'm always struck by the fear behind those insults.
So if you're beginning to see some of this in the late 80s, early 90s, what do you think about the way the mainstream media approaches pretty much any given subject today, where, the President of the United States talks, ceaselessly about fake news and that's not true. And it does just seem like there's so many journalists that are not interested in facts or evidence at all.
Yeah, well, they've they know the broader truth. The broader truth is that, you know, President Trump is a completely evil man at whose door can be laid all the ills of America and the world. They know that. Everything has to fit into that template. Right. Everything. And I've seen this in Britain over the years, that the media fixate on a story. And for various reasons, they need to believe that story is absolutely true. And so everything that they touch is twisted to make that story effectively be seen to be true. Mm-hmm. It's crazy. And if you say to them that's what they're doing, then by definition, you, the person saying this to them, are extreme. Because in their minds, they are the centre ground. They are the custodians of truth and fairness and balance. If you talk to the people at CNN, MSNBC, the New York Times, that's what they'd all say. We're the people who are fair and balanced. Why are they fair and balanced? Because it's axiomatically true and it cannot be denied and it cannot be challenged that Trump is evil. They start with the conclusion and then all the evidence is twisted to fit the conclusion.
We have, I'm sure you've heard of Rush Limbaugh, a commentator in America who really is he understands the way the left thinks. And I think that's what draws so many people to him, is that in a lot of cases he'll anticipate right. the way they'll react. And as I was reading your book, I thought you have, just because even because of your background, where you came from and then the transition that happened during the 80s and 90s, that one of the things that really stands out in your writings is that you do know how they, and I think you just yes. explained it right there, you know how they think.
That's
and
right.
you know the way that they're going to respond to something.
Right.
You know the way that they're going to argue it.
I think I do. I mean, it sounds a little egocentric to say that, but I think I do. And I think that's why I'm in a specially reserved circle of hell, as far as they're concerned. There are plenty of people who've moved from what they consider to be the left to what they consider to be the right. That doesn't disturb them so much. They may shout at them, but it doesn't get under their skin. I get under their skin. And I think that's part of the reason
right.
Why. But I also, you kindly mentioned my memoir, Guardian Angel, which is indeed about what happened to me. But I also wrote a novel called The Legacy. And in that novel, I created as fictional characters some of the people that I've encountered in my world. And in fact, my hero, who's a kind of anti-hero, is drawn directly from that way of thinking, that you know, his views cannot be explained other than by a personal kind of psychological need to hang on to that vision of himself and himself in the world and the vision of the world. And it's very, very hard to break it, to break into it. It's extremely hard to break into it. There are some people who... There's a number of people who have made a kind of journey analogous to mine. But a number of them, I think, only started on that journey after 9/11, mm-hmm. when suddenly their whole worldview changed for different reasons. And then they started to recalibrate what they previously thought. And there's a number of people who have gone through that process.
Quite a few in the States as well, yeah.
Yeah.
I failed to mention my colleague is here with us, Brad McDonald, and she just mentioned her novel from last year, The Legacy, and you read that. I don't want to put you on the spot because it was a few months ago, but you said you read that last summer.
Yeah, I read it on vacation in Greece. Very enjoyable. So I guess it's about a BBC producer. He's in his middle ages. And if I remember correctly, his father dies and his father's Jewish. And as a young man, he kind of shed his Jewishness. And then his father dies and he reconnects with his Jewish heritage. So as I read that, you know, I just wondered, is it biographical? Are you kind of writing your
not
story?
Really, no. I mean, there are certain biographical elements in the novel. And I've drawn on my own, you know, background growing up and you know, characters that I've met over time. But my hero or anti-hero is not me. He's a type that I've met. I'm very, very, very typical of the British Jewish community, which is very kind of defensive often. If they're not particularly connected to the religion or the community, they're very defensive about their Jewishness because it's regarded as a sign of otherness in Britain, and it makes people very defensive, and then they fall reflexively into kind of anti-Israelism. And one of the things I wanted to bring out in the novel, which has become ever more topical, is contemporary anti-Semitism on the left. Yeah. And as we're speaking now, Britain is going through, or the Labour Party is going through, an absolute tumult with, you know, was it the last count, 8 members of parliament leaving the party, in part over anti-Semitism. And it's a phenomenon that's not just in Britain, but it's, in fact, it's in Europe and also in America. And it's one of the, you know, it's an unanswerable question why anti-Semitism exists and why the Jews have been the world's scapegoat more or less ever since the Jews were invented in biblical times. And you can produce many theories for it. None of them really gets the essential mystery of it. But one of the things that I do think, which is true of today's uproar over anti-Semitism in Britain and in Europe in particular, is that anti-Semitism is at its most virulent and most dangerous when a society loses faith in itself and loses its sense of what it is. When a society is confident in what it is, it doesn't need scapegoats. It just gets on with it. And so there's always anti-Semitism, but it's minimal. When a society feels itself to be fragmenting and the people don't know what they are and they don't know what they belong to, and then they turn on what appears to be, you know, the weakest part of the population, who are minorities. And the Jews are, you know, have been historically, have got it in the neck from everybody and in these circumstances. And that's what's happening today. And I wanted to show in this novel the continuity of anti-Semitism. I mean, the novel is over a very large canvas, as you probably know. It touches upon medieval Britain. It touches upon Holocaust Poland. It touches upon contemporary Britain. And it touches upon the State of Israel. And I wanted to show the kind of continuity of hatred. But I also wanted to get under the skin of the people involved. You know, what does it do to a British Jew to be the target of this? What is it? Why are people so? What goes through someone's mind when he hates Jewish people? And I don't claim to have got to the bottom of this, but I wanted to kind of imaginatively bring this to life. And I also wanted to show other things. I wanted to show the tremendous pull of history, that none of us can actually escape our history, that we all, you know, to create our healthy identity, we need to situate ourselves in our own history and to connect to other people in that history, and that it claims us, whether or not we like, you know, even if we try and escape it, it claims us. And I wanted to show that.
Just a couple of things to squeeze in before we run out of time. You mentioned the fragmenting society, and you said in Guardian Angel, both of these books, I should repeat, can be purchased on Amazon.com. Guardian Angel, Melanie Phillips's memoir from, what was it, 2012?
Well, no, it was republished, it was updated and republished last year.
Okay, and then the novel was from last year as well.
A couple of months later, yeah.
Okay, right. In any event, you said that in Guardian Angel that your biggest break from the left had to do with the breakdown of the family.
Yes,
and
yes.
As a Christian organization, we have a lot to say about the breakdown of the family and how that has a devastating impact on society. But if I can just take you to a quote, this is in the middle of the book, your book. It says, "And when I started writing about family breakdown, I was also called an Old Testament fundamentalist. At the time, I shrugged this aside as merely a gratuitous bit of bigotry. Much later, however, I came to realize that it was actually a rather precise insult My assailants had immediately understood something I did not myself at the time understand, that the destruction of the traditional family had, as its real target, the destruction of biblical morality.
Correct.
Tell me more about that.
Yes, I mean, I said correct, I wrote it. yes, it took me a long time to work this out. I mean, you know, when it was first hurled at me, I just thought, oh, that's just anti-Semitism, that's terrible. They're just trying to get at me. And it took me a long time to realise what was going on in the culture, that all this leftist stuff wasn't just, you know, trying to create a different kind of world. It was a very precisely targeted attack right. on biblical morality. Everything is to do with biblical morality. The replacement of a whole exterior code of ethics and morality by what's relative to me, for example. Man-made global warming. This idea that everything would be fine on planet Earth if it wasn't for the human race. And I read, in terms, ideologues of this movement saying that, you know, what's in their sight, what was in their sights, the target, was the view expressed in Genesis that man is given dominion over the earth and over the animals and over nature. Mm-hmm. And they interpreted dominion as kind of colonialism. Whereas actually, I mean, I'm Jewish and, you know, we interpret dominion as being stewardship. Mm-hmm. We have a duty to steward the earth.
Right.
But nevertheless, we are in a position over the animals.
Right.
I went through ideology after ideology, and it was all basically anti-Bible. And the stuff about family was absolutely anti-Bible in every sense. The biblical codes by which we put our own physical appetites. We put constraints on our own physical appetites in the interests of others, particularly our children, to whom we have a duty.
Yeah.
This had to be upended. And so I came to realise, as you've just quoted, that the Old Testament fundamentalist was very, very precisely targeted. They knew what they were against. It took me a long time to realise what they were actually against, but they knew what they were against. Their target was the Bible. And it had to be replaced by a secular utilitarian view of the world, which replaced God by man.
Right.
As the pinnacle of creation, as the pinnacle of everything, as the ultimate authority.
Yeah, you said, and when you were writing about some of these studies that were coming out in the early 1990s, talking about the impact of fatherlessness would have on the home, that truth was sacrificed to expediency. The truth of these studies, your colleagues at The Guardian, they didn't want to hear it.
It wasn't just my colleagues at The Guardian. One of the shattering things that I discovered was the corruption of social science. Hmm. That there were professors of this and that in social science who were, you know, doing research on family dynamics. And they were skewing the evidence in order to minimise the impact of divorce. At that time, right. It was all about divorce.
It has to fit the worldview that they
yes.
have.
Yeah. And what's more, it was when it came to family breakdown, it was particularly bitter because it wasn't just an ideological worldview, which of course it was, but it wasn't just that. It was their own lives. Mm-hmm. They themselves had, you know, walked out on their spouses.
Right.
They themselves felt guilt they'd abandoned their children. They had to make it right in their minds that the children were better off
right.
by the fact that the marriage had collapsed.
Right.
And that was a research. And there, I encountered some researchers, and I wrote about them. It was deeply shocking. They were Christian. They were two Christian researchers, and they were absolutely pucker researchers. They got, you know, they had grants from the relevant social science grant-making body, and they did a piece of research which showed that, and I forget now the precise details, but broadly it showed that it was only in circumstances where the marriage had broken down in really terrible circumstances, where there were extremes of behaviour, that the child was better off outside better off if the marriage was dissolved. In other respects, where there was a kind of grumbling unhappiness and the spouses had parted, the child suffered. And they were subjected to the most extraordinary campaign of vilification on the basis that they were Christian and that therefore their research could not be trusted. You know, secular academics,
right.
Their research is like completely neutral and objective because they're secular. Christian was suspect. They had an agenda. Yeah. They had an agenda and they lost all their grant funding. They couldn't work. I was astounded by this. And I then realised that not just social science, but academia as a whole was, you know, in parts corrupt. When it came up against one of these ideological agendas, it was corrupted. And that's shattering, because then who do you believe?
Right.
If you want to follow the evidence,
worse today as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But if you want to follow the evidence, you know, how do you know which evidence to follow?
Right. You have so much to say about education in your memoir as well, and we'll have to have you back for another time to get more into that. But just one, I guess, small piece of that. You visited our campus in Edmond, Oklahoma, Armstrong College.
We I have did. A small, very impressive it was.
Yeah, very much. Well, hopefully we can have you back at some point. And we have a small campus at Edstone near Stratford-upon-Avon. Mm-hmm. And one thing that we've really been stressing to our students is to just supplement their education, which is a Bible-based education in our case, with outside reading and history. You mentioned early on in your life, going from the memoir, that because of some of the family difficulties you had, you immersed yourself into books and reading. And of course, you had a really good education, too, at Oxford, as you said. But how much of your education and just the development of it over the years has been impacted by just your love for reading and study and research?
It's all about reading, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I don't actually consider myself to be very well educated. I came to the conclusion after 3 years reading English literature at Oxford, I read the wrong subject. I should have read, I much prefer to, retrospectively, I would have preferred to have read history, because then I would have understood a lot more about the world. English literature, actually, it broadens your moral horizons. It enables you to understand character, which is important. But I would have liked to have, you know, known about, I would like to have had the knowledge that a history degree would have imparted. And unlike in America, in Britain, we don't carry on doing degrees. It's one degree and that's it. You know, you've had your 3 years, that's it. Now get on with life. Yeah. It's that kind of attitude. Or it was. But subsequently, I do a lot of reading of all kinds of obscure books and works in connection with my journalism. And, it, you know, it's at different times I've read different things. You know, when I was writing about education, when I was writing about family, writing about multiculturalism, writing about Islam, I read, you know, it takes me in different directions.
Yeah.
But I'm all the time just trying to catch up, trying to sort of, you know, read all the stuff I've not yet got round to reading.
How much reading do you have that you're doing because of your writing assignments, and how much, like, for week to week, how much reading is, well, I just need to read history or study this as well? Is it kind of
It's impossible
depends?
To say. I mean, I'm reading all the time.
Yeah.
I'm reading all kinds of sources all the time.
Right. On history, you mentioned that as maybe you should have taken that instead. There's just articles every week, especially in America, coming out where at the university level,
oh, for sure.
They don't have to take one history course, or if they do, it's revisionist
this
history.
True. This is true.
And so who do you turn to? How do you counter this?
you just have to, like everything else, you have to kind of work out who you rely on.
Yeah.
How do you work out who to trust, who to rely on? Well, you have to compare, you have to see whether the works, first of all, you have to see whether the work stands the test of time.
Yeah.
If his or her work has stood the test of time, then, you know, it encourages you to rely on it. But I never rely on anybody. I always have a part of my mind which says, let's be a bit sceptical.
Yeah.
But there are people who I, you know, respect a great deal because their work has stood the test of time. The quality of their thinking is original and deep, and the internal logic is so outstanding. I mean, I've read many people, but two people who have particularly influenced me are Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, former chief rabbi of Britain, who is a trained philosopher, and who basically gives you a kind of understanding of how Western civilization developed, mm-hmm. And he communicates that in a way which I think is unparalleled in its economy and its breadth and its scope and its depth. And a second person who I have learned a great deal from is another philosopher called Roger Scruton, Professor Sir Roger Scruton, who writes on a lot on aesthetics, on music, and on the countryside. And he's an original thinker. And he illuminates the modern condition in a way that is profound, and it makes sense. It helps make sense of the world. And there are others, and many others that I've read and, you know, enjoy and like and rely on and go back to. You know, there are certain historians that or certain historical books that I rate. Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a minefield because there are so many charlatans, some of whom actually have stellar international reputations. And when you read them, you think, actually, you know, there are holes in this. There are illogicalities. There are discrepancies. I know from my own knowledge that one or two things are not right. They're mistakes. So why has this guy got such a stellar reputation? Answer, because he's fashionable. Why is he fashionable? Because he's wonderful on television. He's a wonderful performer. He's a wonderful communicator. And he is. He is. And that's a great skill. And it's a great talent. And there's a lot to be said for that. But he's shallow. And there are several people, I won't say any names, but there are several people who fit, for me, into that category.
Yeah.
And so I'm always cautious.
Yeah.
I'm always thinking, does this really stand up? And I'm always open to the idea that, you know, that it's not, or that I've got it wrong.
Yeah. What about just the love for history? How would you encourage a 19-year-old in college to get more excited about and interested in history?
Well, I suppose to get excited about history, you've got to be really engaged with the society you're in, or the culture that you're in, or whatever the history is that you're hopefully going to be looking at.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're not really engaged with the culture you're in or the society you're in, you're not. I mean, who cares where it came from? Who cares what made it? I mean, you know, all these boring institutions of the past. But if, for example, you know, you're really engaged by, you know, what makes America great, what makes Britain Britain, what is the uniqueness of Britain? If you really believe, you know, there's something unique about Britain, which I do,
right.
Or that there is something uniquely wonderful about America, which so many Americans believe, then you kind of want to find out, you know, well, what made that? Whereas if you actually either don't care, or unfortunately what we're now training our children to believe is that Britain was, you know, Britain's history was awful, it did terrible things, and America similarly. You know, America has a history which is basically bigoted and horrible and racist, and that's it, bang.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then why should you care?
Right.
And the only things you want to read about are things which validate that.
Right.
And it makes you so depressed anyway. I mean, you're not interested. Yeah. You've got to actually love the country and love the culture.
Yeah.
And feel an identification with it. Now, how do you do that? I think, as I said, I just mentioned, I think one of the most important things, which is a terrible problem, and we, you know, how you get out of this, I do not know. But both in Britain and in America, and they've gone in kind of lockstep over, I would say, in Britain, certainly 40 years. You know, we've kind of diseducated our young, and young are now the teachers,
right,
of the young, or the teachers of the teachers. But, you know, we've given them a story of their culture, which is one of almost unbridled awfulness. We've taught them to hate.
Yeah.
what they are. We've really taught them to hate it. And this is a terrible thing, because how do you start unraveling that? Who do you go to unravel it? If the teachers themselves have been brought up, have themselves been educated or diseducated in that way, where do you go to change this? This, I think, is the most difficult thing of all. How do you change a culture? How do you repair a culture from within, given that you have to use the culture to repair it? It's a conundrum I can't answer.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to get into that on the next segment that we have. You spend, you said you spend most of your time in Jerusalem, but you do shuttle back and forth to London.
I very much shuttle. I very much between, I consider myself between two worlds, actually. I'm still completely bound up with what's going on in Britain, which at the moment is a state of almost terminal awfulness and hysteria over Brexit. I care very much about Britain. My work is mainly centred in Britain. My husband is based in Britain.
Right.
And I have a son and grandchildren in Britain and a daughter and grandchildren in Israel. So I go back and forth between the two.
Yeah. Well, it's probably easier for us to connect with you here because you live not very far from this apartment. But we'd love to have you up at Edstone. That's an hour and a half, I think, away from London. So come up and see us sometime.
That's really
Melanie
nice.
Phillips,
thank you.
The author of Guardian Angel and The Legacy, both of them available at Amazon.com. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for your time. Much appreciated.
You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.